process they used to tie Brooks to Courtney Smith's murder had become their modus operandi. Hain would find suspicious marks, conclude they were bite marks, and then bring West in to match them to the chief suspect. It's a process they had repeated before and would repeat over and over again. During cross-examination, Hain told Prather that he had assembled a sexual assault kit for Courtney Smith. Hain was unable to collect any semen or pubic hairs that could be tested for DNA, though he would only say on the stand that he didn't know if the crime lab was able to test anything in the kit. Investigators did find male hairs on a blanket, including a male pubic hair that did not belong to anyone in Courtney Smith's family. It also didn't belong to LaVon Brooks. Again, this left the bite marks as the only physical evidence tying Brooks to the crime scene. There was one especially odd moment in Hain's testimony, though more for all good than for Hain. After Hain described the cuts in the victim's vagina, Allgood asked what could have caused them. Hain speculated that it could have been a finger or a penis. Allgood then interjected, seemingly from nowhere, a broom handle, for example. Allgood would return to the broom handle in his redirect of Hain, and then again in his closing argument. It isn't clear where this came from or why Allgood brought it up. It was an oddly specific reference, yet there was no broom found near the crime scene, and no broom handle was ever entered into evidence. We also now know how the crime happened. It didn't involve a broom. A conscientious medical examiner should have responded that while, yes, it is possible that the injuries could have been created with a broom handle, there was no evidence favoring that over a finger, a penis, or any other narrow, bluntly pointed object. But Hain simply agreed with Allgood. Yes, a broom handle was possible. Allgood was engaging in a particularly devious rhetorical device here. Visualization can be incredibly persuasive. The more a prosecutor can get a jury to visualize the defendant committing the crime, the easier it becomes to convince them that he's the culprit. One way to help them visualize the defendant committing the crime is to provide lots of detail. Particularly striking, powerful, or emotional details are especially effective. Allgood knew the jury would be told that there was no semen found in the victim, so getting them to visualize Brooks raping the girl would be difficult. But Brooks, a grown man, raping a small girl with a broom handle? That's a powerfully horrifying image. Stephen Hain later billed Noxubee County $1,950 for his testimony. A couple of nights before his testimony, Michael West walked into Rose's, a local discount mart. He picked up two packs of cigarettes, a bag of Skittles, mounting tape, tack glides, and a wispy walker, a near-life-size doll of a little girl that he'd use in a demonstration for the jury. West took the stand on January 16th, day 4 of the trial. Allgood had made it clear early on that West would be a critical part of his case. In November 1991, he sent Prather a copy of West's incredibly long CV, along with some purportedly friendly professional advice. I wouldn't challenge his qualifications. Prather didn't try to get West disqualified before trial, but he did manage to get some funds to hire his own expert. That expert, Dr. Harry Mincer of Knoxville, Tennessee, had testified against West in other cases, but he wasn't a bite mark skeptic. He was a practitioner. He would prove to be almost as damaging to LaVon Brooks as Michael West. Allgood began by running through West's qualifications. West told Allgood he held the position of senior crime scene analyst. He noted that he had been on the Phil Donahue show and had testified in 13 states, and then he named each one. He then ran off the various places where he claimed to have lectured or taught courses on bite marks or ultraviolet light. He ended, as he often did, with the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. When it was his turn to ask West about his qualifications, Prather asked just one: whether the American Dental Association recognized the field of forensic odontology as a specialty. West said that it did not. When Allgood followed up, West explained that the ADA only allowed dentists to specialize in one area. So he was glad that forensic odontology wasn't one of those areas, or he'd have to choose between forensics and his dental practice. "You have to eat, right, doctor?" Allgood asked. "Yes, sir," West replied. They then moved on to the case at hand. Allgood first asked West about the fact that Courtney Smith had been embalmed before his examination, and what effect that might have had on his analysis. West answered that it would minimize the tendency of skin samples to retract after they'd been extracted. Allgood had anticipated that Prather would ask West about the embalming, which would alter and distort the skin. He also knew that West would be asked about his failure to apply a retainer to keep the skin sample in its pre-existing shape once it was extracted from the body. West's answer solved both problems. The embalming process's tendency to minimize skin shrinkage had serendipitously counteracted West's failure to use a retainer. Thus, the bite mark and all the minute details within it that he'd later claim were critical to his ability to match it to Levon Brooks had been perfectly preserved. Allgood next asked West how bite marks could be matched to a specific person. West responded that everyone's teeth are unique, citing a study from the early 1980s that has since been widely debunked and didn't actually prove the uniqueness of human dentition in the first place. Allgood followed up, "Just like fingerprints or tool marks, then?" "Exactly," West responded. Allgood walked West through his exclusion of the first 12 dental molds provided to him by the sheriff's office, and then his analysis of Levon Brooks's mold 2 days later. This exchange followed. Allgood: "All right. And is that man sitting in the courtroom right now?" West: "He doesn't look the way I... His appearance has changed from when the time I saw him." Allgood: "Okay." West: "This is a photograph of what he looked like the day I examined him." Allgood: "Okay, but is this, in fact, the same man?" West: I believe I can look at his teeth and tell you if it's him." Laughter in courtroom. One could almost forget that a man's life hung in the balance. The transcript doesn't indicate whether Levon Brooks thought this was funny. West then began to explain how he could say that Levon Brooks, and only Levon Brooks, could have left the marks on Courtney Smith's wrist. But before he could get too far into his answer, Allgood needed one more piece of misinformation. "Now, let me back you up just a second," Allgood said. "First of all, doctor, these examinations, are they generally accepted in the scientific community as being positive for the positive identification of an individual through a bite mark?" "Yes, sir," West said. West was wrong. Bite mark analysis may have been accepted at the time in parts of the forensics community, though it has always been controversial even there, but its underlying assumptions have never been verified or accepted by the scientific community. West then went deep into the details of his analysis. He invoked technical dental terms and interspersed them with the parlance of bite mark analysis. He explained how the cutting edges of Levon Brooks's teeth had very definite fractures and bevels. He talked about their L-shaped curve and how one tooth had a scalloped-out area with a sharp edge. On the backsides of his teeth, Brooks had some chips and fractures and some wear, what we call wear facets. The facets were apparently how West made his positive identification. When you open and close your teeth, and as you get older, the upper and lower teeth wear together so that the cutting edge of the lower teeth actually wears a groove in the back of the upper teeth, he said. West then talked about the orientation and location of the alleged bite. He first had to determine how the assailant was oriented to the victim to leave the sort of bite he had just analyzed. To demonstrate, West used the Wispy Walker doll he'd bought at the discount mart. Then there was the skin itself. Being bit on the skin on your arm is different from being bit on the skin on your stomach or your buttocks or on your legs, West explained. You have to determine, is this tissue flabby? Is it firm? Does it have a lot of fat? Does it have a lot of give? Is it supported? Is it tight, loose, etc.? So what you're actually looking at is if he's in this position and taking into account these anatomical properties of the skin, you try to determine what type of dynamics are going to occur when the teeth grab into the skin and pull across it. The first part of West's answer is unquestionably true. It's one of the main reasons why bite mark analysis just isn't credible. There's simply no way to systematically account for so many variables, along with countless others, such as whether and how much the victim resisted, whether the bite was direct or grazing, which direction the victim may have attempted to pull away, how the victim heals, and the aforementioned problem of skin samples shrinking after excision. Neither West nor any other bite mark analyst has ever offered a calculable way to measure, quantify, or adjust for all of these variables. Instead, they simply eyeball it. They guesstimate. They approximate. That means that the weight of their opinions swings almost entirely on their personal credibility and their ability to persuade. And that means that establishing their credibility with cops, prosecutors, judges, and juries is critically important, far more important than the content of their testimony. This is why West built out a 20-plus page CV. It's why he collected titles, and it's why he wrote articles for every magazine, newsletter, and journal that would publish him. Even given West's typical nonsense about bite mark matching, his testimony in Brooks's case was especially hard to swallow. The marks on Courtney Smith's wrist were tiny and wouldn't be easily identifiable as bite marks to any mere layperson. West needed to account for this. So he posited that Brooks only bit the girl with his two upper incisors, and that only portions of Brooks's incisors actually left those marks. In other words, West was making a positive identification of Brooks based only on two small marks made by portions of just two of Brooks's teeth. Fortunately, West assured the jury, his pioneering technique with ultraviolet light was perfectly suited for such intricacies. West said the details were too complicated for a lay jury. He added that he was currently involved in a project to fully describe all of the, biochemical, electrophysical, and optical properties of skin, but that for a thumbnail sketch, damaged tissue absorbs UV. Healthy, intact tissue does not. He said his technique utilized those properties to reveal minute tears and patterns in Courtney Smith's skin that could only have been created by the teeth that bit her. West next explained that the plaster models he had created of Brooks's teeth didn't provide enough detail for such a delicate analysis. He needed a material capable of capturing more detail. So West revisited Brooks in jail and had him open his mouth again while West pressed silly putty, actual silly putty, against the back of Brooks's upper incisors. The reason? West said silly putty was better for recording the intricate facets on the back of Brooks's front tooth that he needed to capture in order to compare the corresponding bunching he found deep in the alleged wound on Courtney Smith's wrist. It's important to appreciate the full scope of West's creativity here. He was claiming that the dental substrate he had carefully applied to Brooks's teeth in a controlled environment, a material designed to capture and preserve the unique characteristics of a patient's teeth, was insufficient to convey the level of detail he needed to make a positive identification. Yet somehow, the spongy, fungible skin of a 3-year-old girl was able to record and preserve those same nuances. This after a bite allegedly delivered outside, as the biter was committing a murder and sexual assault, and after the body had been submerged in water for 36 hours, had dried out, and had been embalmed. Moreover, in his initial analysis of Brooks's teeth, West concluded that they were highly consistent with the alleged bite mark, but not a match. Allgood's office then asked West if he could give them something more certain. That's when West turned to the silly putty, the goggles, and the ultraviolet light, just to be certain. After running through his analysis, West confidently told the jury, "I have no doubt that the teeth of LaVon Brooks did and indeed leave the bite mark on the wrist of Courtney Smith." During cross-examination, Prather got West to admit that bite mark matching was a subjective field, and at the time was practiced by only 92 people in the country. He also got West to admit to some pretty embarrassing mistakes. West had actually lost the dental molds taken from Sonia Smith, preventing expert Harry Mincer from analyzing them. More crucially, West had also lost the lower dental mold of LaVon Brooks. And as important as he claimed the silly putty had been to his analysis, he didn't preserve that either. He sent Mincer only black and white photos he had taken of the silly putty after pressing it against Brooks's teeth. There was, of course, no way Mincer could verify from two-dimensional photographs all those intricate details West claimed to have found. Everyone would just have to take West's word for it. West also admitted to something that would come up in future cases. One step of his analysis actually involved pressing the suspect's dental mold directly into the alleged bite marks on the victim. This method of analysis has been strongly denounced by other forensic experts who have pointed out in this and other cases that it distorts the evidence and may even create marks where none existed before. Later, video from two other cases in which West used this method would strongly suggest he did exactly that. He actually created the marks he claimed came from the defendant. At the time, however, the direct comparison method was deemed acceptable by the American Board of Forensic Odontology, in part because West was so influential in the early years of that organization. The ABFO has since abandoned the method. In this case, it was especially wrong-headed. Human skin gets increasingly fragile and pliable as it begins to decay. Courtney Smith's body had been submerged in water for 36 hours. By pushing Brooks's dental mold directly into the skin, West was distorting the skin, possibly even creating the very patterns he would later say were crucial to his conclusions. He was also altering the skin so that no subsequent expert could analyze the sample in its original condition, making it impossible for anyone to verify his conclusions. Prather asked West about this. How could he be sure that he hadn't altered the mark itself? West responded, "I did my best to see that that didn't happen." On redirect, Allgood asked West about how he compensated for distortion. How did he know how to adjust for decomposition, healing, embalming, retraction, variations in skin, and the myriad other variables that could alter a bite mark? West gave a meandering answer. "Every bite mark or wound pattern has a degree of distortion," he said. "To me, the whole technique of being able to analyze wound patterns is actually the ability to compensate for distortion." Again, he merely eyeballed it. He went on, "When I take impressions of teeth, they are not exact duplicates because the word exact means exact. There is going to be a difference of maybe a few microns." This was classic West, faux humility followed by outlandish boasting. It's also meaningless drivel. A micron is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. The width of a human hair is 10 to 200 microns. The substrate that dentists use to make molds of patients' teeth is thick and gloppy. The process by which the mold is pushed into teeth and then removed is messy and imprecise. The end product is a reasonable likeness of teeth for the purposes of orthodontia or cosmetic alterations, but the notion that it could be an exact replica to within a few microns is ludicrous. West closed his testimony with a doozy. He said he wanted to make sure the jury knew of his fidelity to his vocation and his recognition of the seriousness of this particular case. On the one hand, he explained, he was well aware that his expert opinion could likely cost a man his freedom. But he also understood that if he helped implicate the wrong man, it might also allow an individual to still be loose in the community. For those reasons, Michael West assured the jury, he went the extra mile on this one. In the end, West managed to do both. He helped an innocent man lose his freedom and helped a killer to remain loose in the community. He then billed Noxubee County $2,902.12 for his testimony. To make the rest of its case, the state also called Deputy Ernest Eichelberger, Investigator Harry Alderson, Sheriff Cecil Russell, and various members of the Smith family. Brooks's attorneys called several witnesses who put Brooks at the Santa Barbara Club until 3 or 3:30 a.m. The defense also tried to show that Eichelberger's investigation was sloppy and incomplete. No one asked Uncle Bunky to testify. The most interesting witness for the defense was Sonia Smith, Courtney's mother. Consistent with her affidavit, Sonia Smith testified that when she and Brooks dated, he had never come into her home. At most, she said, she might go out to meet him in his car, but they usually met somewhere else. She verified that they had broken up months before Courtney's death, and that Brooks had never been to her current residence on Phillips Loop. After the defense rested, the judge advised LaVon Brooks of his right to testify. He declined. The trial then moved to closing arguments. In addition to the misinformation he fed the jury about Ashley Smith's testimony, Allgood's closing argument in the guilt phase of Brooks's trial was basically a rehashing of the evidence, or in the case of the fictitious broom handle, non-evidence. Prather had pointed out to the jury that the state had called no witnesses from the crime lab. That's because there was no biological evidence to link Brooks to the crime scene. Allgood countered this by hanging his hat on one of the least reliable forms of evidence, eyewitness testimony from a child, and in this case, Ashley Smith. "You don't get any better evidence than that," he said. Allgood told the jury that the investigation didn't really get rolling until Ashley picked Brooks out of that first photo lineup. Guess whose teeth marks then wind up on her sister's body, but the same man she pointed out? Allgood asked. Gee, what a coincidence. Gosh, that's funny how that worked out, isn't it? Of course, it wasn't a coincidence at all. On the witness stand, Michael West had a history of matching bite marks on a body to the authorities' chief suspect. The jury began deliberations around 6 p.m. on January 17, 1992. After 3 hours, the foreman told the judge that they were irreconcilably divided. The vote stood at 10-2. The defense asked for a mistrial. The judge refused and told the jury to retire for the night. They would begin deliberations again in the morning. At 2:25 p.m. the following afternoon, the jury announced that they had reached a verdict. The bailiff brought Brooks in to hear his fate. The judge warned the courtroom against outbursts or displays of emotion. When he was finished, the court clerk read the verdict. "We, the jury, find LaVon Brooks guilty of capital murder." Court would resume the following Monday morning to decide if Brooks would die. That Monday morning happened to be Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which at the time wasn't yet officially observed in Mississippi. As most of the rest of the country paid homage to the civil rights leader, a jury, who had just convicted Brooks based on evidence produced by an archaic system designed to cover up lynchings, would now decide if he should live or die. A monument to fallen Confederate soldiers stood just outside the courthouse. During the sentencing phase, Forrest Allgood recalled Stephen Hain, who testified that Courtney Smith likely suffered a lot of pain as she was assaulted and murdered, an attempt to establish that the crime was especially heinous. Prather called Brooks's parents, who pleaded for mercy and told the jury that Brooks was a sweet boy. Both stated that they didn't believe he had committed the crime. Prather also called Brooks's girlfriend, Barbara Pippin, with whom Brooks had a 1-year-old daughter. She was born shortly after he was arrested. Pippin testified that she had 2 kids of her own and that Brooks had always been helpful and kind to them. The defense called Brooks's sister, Patricia Rice. She had four daughters and said Brooks often helped her take care of them. They also called a teacher from the elementary school where Brooks worked. She merely testified that Brooks was cordial and punctual, but the real intent may have been to get the jury to decline a death sentence by making them doubt Brooks's guilt. Jurors had now heard three separate witnesses say that Brooks had cared for or had access to children, yet Courtney Smith's murder was the first time he had ever been accused of harming one. The defense also called Sonia Smith. She too asked that the jury give Brooks a life sentence. That the victim's mother requested her daughter's convicted killer be spared the death penalty must have had a profound effect on the jury. It's also clear that Sonia Smith was never entirely convinced that LaVon Brooks was guilty. Allgood then rose to present his closing. He began with three arguments that were unassailable. First, the crime had been committed in the course of a sexual battery. Second, the crime was committed in the course of a kidnapping. And third, the murder was especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel. These were all easy things to prove. There was no question that Courtney Smith was abducted from her home, sexually assaulted, and tossed in a pond to die. And LaVon Brooks had just been convicted for it. Allgood then closed his case with a particularly heartless tactic. He waged a ruthless attack on Sonia Smith, Courtney's mother. He began by telling the jury that Smith had failed her daughter in life, implying it was her fault that a man had abducted Courtney from her home, raped her, and murdered her. Allgood went on. Just because she does not believe in the death penalty, just because she does not believe that's the appropriate sentence, does that somehow erase the monstrosity of what was done? Does that somehow make it okay? That it's okay to kill little girls in Noxubee County, Mississippi, if their mother agrees to it? It's hard to comprehend how Sonia Smith must have felt upon hearing all of that. She had just lost her daughter to an especially heinous murder. Now this prosecutor, who presented himself as the champion of victims everywhere, was accusing her in open court of tacitly approving her own 3-year-old daughter's rape and murder, simply because she'd asked the jury to spare LaVon Brooks's life. Allgood then reared back for one last swing. She was not the best mother to Courtney in life, and she remains so even in death, he said. Allgood wielded the sword and shield for crime victims everywhere, just so long as they didn't stand between him and the execution chamber. He continued, "You are told that the world is full of cruelty, and it is." Sonia Smith undoubtedly agreed. To begin their closing argument in the sentencing phase of the trial, LaVon Brooks's attorneys asked LaVon himself to address the jury. "I know I have been found guilty of capital murder," he said, "but one thing I want y'all to know. I want y'all to have mercy on me and don't kill me because I didn't do it. Thank you." Brooks sat down. Brooks's attorneys then argued several mitigating factors. They argued that Brooks's crime may have been caused by the fact that he was emotionally disturbed and of limited intelligence. Neither of these things was true, of course. They were trying to save his life. Still, they had already put a psychologist on the stand who claimed Brooks suffered damage to the portion of his brain that governs judgment and restraint. That isn't uncommon in capital cases, but one can only imagine what Brooks must have made of it. Until all of this, he was a cheerful, well-liked man with a great job, a lot of friends, and a baby girl. Now, in the hope of sparing his own life, he had to sit and listen as his attorneys argued in open court about a defect in his brain that made him want to rape and murder little girls. Brooks's attorneys also pointed to his good behavior in the time he had been incarcerated and awaiting trial, his Christian background, and the fact that his victim's family had asked for him to be spared. Prather's co-counsel, a black man, invoked the state's history of lynching, though more as a rhetorical flourish than to draw any comparisons between the death investigation system that covered up lynchings and the one that had just convicted Brooks. While they couldn't argue that Brooks was innocent, both attorneys made sure to acknowledge that the jury had already found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. They did tell the jury that they could spare Brooks's life if they still had any doubt at all, anything less than reasonable doubt. They then begged the jury to err on the side of caution. The jury retired to deliberate, and at 7:25 p.m. sent a note to the court that they had reached a decision. Bailiffs brought Brooks from his jail cell back to the courtroom. The foreman passed a slip of paper to the court clerk, who then read it aloud. "We, the jury, find that the defendant should be sentenced to imprisonment for life in the Mississippi Department of Corrections." Levon Brooks would live. Chapter 10. Keep That Woman Under Control. When I go into a courtroom and render an opinion, it lays me open to savage attacks by unscrupulous men. Michael West. On June 18, 1993, Mississippi got its fifth state medical examiner. Department of Public Safety Commissioner Jim Ingram appointed Emily Ward, a native Mississippian, to the position. The 37-year-old Ward had been a regional medical examiner in Mobile, Alabama. Ingram announced that Ward would also serve as director of the crime lab, the first person to hold both positions. Perhaps as important as anything else, Ward would have use of the state's brand-new 27,000-square-foot lab and morgue, which had been completed the previous year. The second woman to hold the office, Ward rose to the position even earlier in her career than Faye Spruill. Both were talented doctors and had thrived in an area of medicine that had proven itself open to women, at least comparatively. As in past searches for a medical examiner, though, there had been a shortage of applicants. The salary was still well below the national average, and after the tenures of Thomas Bennett and Lloyd White, the state had a reputation for being hard on those who took the job. Ward's hiring, nevertheless, seemed promising. She was smart, board-certified, and had experience both in and out of the state. Her roots in Mississippi gave her knowledge, or perhaps forewarning, going into the position that her predecessors didn't have. And her experience in the more modernized Alabama system demonstrated to her that improvements were possible. Hinds County Coroner Robert Martin initially touted the hiring, saying he thought Ward's education, experience, and personality would be an asset to the office. But he'd soon become one of her fiercest critics. And Ward would find out quickly that the men who ran the Mississippi criminal justice and death investigation systems weren't any more ready for a woman telling them what to do in 1993 than they were in 1981. In September 1993, 65-year-old Texas medical examiner Ralph Erdman pleaded no contest to 7 counts of faking autopsy reports. Erdman had already given up his medical license the previous month. He was sentenced to 10 years of probation and a $17,000 fine. Since the early 1980s, Erdman had been performing autopsies on a contract basis for as many as 40 rural Texas counties that couldn't afford to hire a forensic pathologist of their own. For the law enforcement officials in those counties who needed an autopsy, Erdman made it awfully easy. He was willing to come to them, saving them the cost of shipping bodies to state labs. But because most of those counties didn't have the proper facilities, Erdman had to improvise. He performed autopsies not just in funeral homes, but also in garages, alleys, and parking lots. According to true crime author Jim Fisher, who profiled some of Erdman's work, Erdman once performed an autopsy on a door laid across 2 55-gallon drums. Erdman also had a reputation for producing key evidence that helped authorities crack difficult cases. He called himself the Quincy of the Texas Panhandle, after the popular TV forensic pathologist played by Jack Klugman. But because Erdman didn't really report to anyone, no one bothered to check just how many autopsies he was doing or how well he was doing them. The only thing that mattered, it seemed, was that he helped the prosecutors and police officials who hired him. By the early 1990s, it began to catch up with him, in part because his sloppiness began to undermine convictions. In one case, he somehow lost the head of a murder victim. That proved a problem for the state, because the head contained the bullet that prosecutors needed to charge their main suspect. In another case, Erdman autopsied the body of a man found in a dumpster with a fresh bullet wound to his head, but Erdman determined that he had died of pneumonia. On several occasions, Erdman had documented the weight of body organs that subsequent investigations revealed he had never removed. When a panel of pathologists was finally convened to review Erdman's work, they found that in a third of the autopsies they reviewed, Erdman hadn't even cut open the body. Still, as Texas defense attorneys began to complain about Erdman, prosecutors didn't budge. Instead, they retaliated. When two police officers testified that Erdman had lied about his results in a case, prosecutors indicted the cops for perjury. One defense attorney who had helped expose Erdman was himself indicted for witness tampering. The tampered witness was Erdman himself, who complained that the attorney had been threatening him. Even after acknowledging his mistakes, Texas officials at first defended Erdman, making the argument that he was simply doing his best to help less affluent counties catch up with mounting caseloads. The parallels to the situation in Mississippi are hard to miss. One Mississippi Supreme Court justice fretted in a 1999 dissenting opinion that after the court's ruling in a bite mark case, we risk having Michael West become the Ralph Erdman of Mississippi. There are a couple of important differences, but they aren't favorable to Mississippi. When Erdman was finally exposed, Texas officials convened a panel of pathologists to review his work. Old cases were reopened and reinvestigated by credible and qualified experts. Erdman was also ultimately held accountable. That still hasn't happened in Mississippi. There is one other major difference between Ralph Erdman and what was occurring with Michael West and Stephen Hain. For years after he was exposed, Erdman was cited as the poster child for bad forensics, a walking, talking argument for more oversight and better checks on expert witnesses. In their 2000 book, Innocence Project co-founders Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld described the number of autopsies Erdman did each year as astonishing. That number? About 300 autopsies per year. In fact, the most autopsies Erdman ever did in a year was 480. In his prime, Hain could pull that off before the magnolias bloomed. For 70 years after the Fry decision, the case that set the standard for distinguishing good expert testimony from bad, the U.S. Supreme Court steered clear of establishing any rules for the use of science in the courtroom. In 1993, the court finally addressed the issue in a series of rulings known as the Daubert decisions. The main decision came in Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, Inc. A group of parents had sued Merrill Dow, the large pharmaceutical company. They alleged that its drug, Bendectin, which pregnant women took for morning sickness, had caused birth defects in their children. Ostensibly, the case required the plaintiffs to provide scientific evidence showing that Bendectin caused changes in embryonic development. It became the landmark case in which the U.S. Supreme Court first began to rethink Fry, expert witness testimony, and the relationship between science and law. On one side of the argument were those who believed that Fry was too rigid, that it excluded emerging science that was valuable but hadn't yet gained general acceptance within its field. On the other were those who believed that the courts needed to reconcile the fundamental epistemological differences between science and law and to adopt a standard that only permitted settled science in court. It was a lot to ask of nine justices, most with very little scientific background. The court ended up attempting to split the difference and may have made things worse. Functionally, the Daubert decisions continued what was perhaps the worst but also most inevitable legacy of Fry, making judges the gatekeepers. The court instructed federal judges to evaluate expert testimony on factors such as whether an expert's claims are testable, whether the conclusions offered are subject to peer review, whether the methods are governed by standards and protocol, the error rate of those methods, and whether a witness's general testimony has been accepted within a particular scientific community. It hasn't worked out well. In many ways, Daubert exacerbated the problems created by Fry. It loosened the standard for the admission of scientific and other technical evidence, but also institutionalized the judge's role as the gatekeeper of such evidence. If that was ever going to work, the Supreme Court should also have required judges to meet some minimum competency of scientific literacy. Of course, it didn't have the power to do that. The fallout has been disastrous. Inconsistent rulings about the same type of evidence from district court to district court and between federal courts of appeals. And to the extent that the courts have been on the same page, it has generally been to let bad science in, which essentially delegates the gatekeeping job to juries. When I read Daubert analyses by judges, it reminds me of what happens when you ask undergraduate students to evaluate the validity of syllogisms, says Professor Michael Sachs. The only thing they know is that they agree with the outcome. And so, instead of going through the analysis to reach their conclusion, they begin with their answer, then bluff their way through the analysis. It's mostly for show. Daubert also exacerbated the ongoing tension between forensic science and science more generally. The former has always seen itself as a tool of the justice system. It was never a product of scientific inquiry. Fields like fingerprinting, arson investigation, blood spatter analysis, ballistics analysis, and tool mark analysis were all developed within the sphere of law enforcement to serve police and prosecutors in solving and prosecuting crimes, not by scientists employing the scientific method. Science is a process of observation, testing of hypotheses, and revision based on the results of those tests. For scientists, being wrong is all part of the pursuit of knowledge. Science is a collaboration. Because forensics was born of our adversarial justice system, it is not collaborative, and in fact tends to be contentious, the pattern-matching fields especially. For a forensic analyst, being wrong means a wrongful conviction, or the wrongful exclusion of a guilty party, and serious damage to an analyst's reputation, though not as much as one might think. Less scrupulous analysts adapt accordingly. They just never admit they're wrong. And because most forensic specialties are entirely subjective, it was for a long time nearly impossible to prove an analyst got it wrong. That is, until DNA. On August 14, 1993, Amy Ware, an elderly woman in Clay County, Mississippi, ate a bologna sandwich for lunch. Sometime that same afternoon, a man broke into her house, robbed her, and murdered her. Suspicion quickly fell on Calvin Banks, who had been playing poker nearby. There was circumstantial evidence to implicate Calvin Banks, but not much, so prosecutors wanted more. Ware's body was taken to Stephen Hain to be autopsied, and Hain then consulted West. Local police had found a half-eaten bologna sandwich at the crime scene and froze it as possible evidence. West wouldn't get around to examining the sandwich for several months, but when he did, he claimed that the bite marks in the sandwich were consistent with the teeth of Calvin Banks and inconsistent with the teeth of Amy Ware. There was one problem, which West apparently hadn't realized. In Ware's stomach, Hain had already documented finding a portion of bologna roughly equal to what was missing from the sandwich that police found in the house. Banks was convicted anyway, but this would become known as the bologna sandwich case, a go-to example of Michael West's excesses. In 1997, the Mississippi Supreme Court threw out Banks' conviction, but not because of West's testimony. Instead, the court was troubled by the fact that West had discarded the sandwich after examining it. Here again, West had matched a critical piece of evidence to a suspect, then destroyed it, thus preventing another analyst and Banks' defense counsel from verifying his findings. West claimed he tried to preserve the sandwich by taking photographs, 3 pieces of meat and 2 pieces of bread, he reported, but the bologna began to putrefy, so he tossed the sandwich in the trash. When asked why he didn't freeze it, West said he had considered doing so, but he found from testing other bologna that the freezing dehydrated and shriveled the meat, making it useless for other analysts. Instead, he took photos. Of course, the sandwich had already been frozen for months before West himself analyzed it. He didn't explain why the freezing process didn't make the bologna unusable for him, but would have made it unusable for any other analyst. In reversing the conviction, the majority emphasized that their opinion should not affect the ability for prosecutors to use West or bite mark evidence in other cases. In fact, the majority opinion arguably affirmed bite mark evidence by finding that it was Banks's inability to have his own forensic odontologist test the sandwich that violated his right to a fair trial. In other words, it wasn't the evidence that was the problem, it was only Banks's inability to test it for himself. There was a dissenting opinion in that case. Mississippi Supreme Court Justice James Smith would have upheld the conviction. In his dissent, Smith referred to the court's ruling earlier that year in the case of Eddie Lee Howard. In 1994, Howard was convicted of raping and murdering 84-year-old Georgia Kemp. The victim's body was found in her Columbus, Mississippi home by firefighters after a neighbor noticed smoke coming from the house. Investigators concluded that the fire had been set intentionally. Kemp's body was taken to Hayne, who concluded that she had been stabbed to death. He also said he found signs of rape, although the rape kit turned up no biological evidence that technology available at the time could test for DNA. Notably, Hayne made no notes in his autopsy indicating he had found possible bite marks. After the autopsy, Georgia Kemp was buried. Eddie Lee Howard was unemployed at the time of the murder, lived with a relative near Kemp's house, and had been arrested before for a sex offense. 3 days after Kemp was buried, law enforcement zeroed in on him as a potential suspect, and West was brought in to take another look at the case. Kemp's body was exhumed. West concluded that some marks that Hayne had identified on Kemp's body, but hadn't noted to be suspicious in his autopsy report, were human bites. He then made an impression of Howard's teeth and concluded that the bites could only have come from Howard. As in other cases, West again made the odd claim Howard had only bitten Kemp with his upper teeth. To claim he could make a unique match based on that was especially suspect in this instance, because Howard's upper teeth had actually been replaced with a manufactured denture. And yet in 1994, Eddie Lee Howard was convicted and sentenced to death. Howard represented himself at his first trial. In 1997, the Mississippi Supreme Court overturned his conviction. In a 5-3 vote, one justice did not participate, the court found that the trial court had improperly allowed Howard to represent himself. But the justices also discussed West and bite mark evidence, and the back and forth was an apt demonstration of just how out of their element judges can be when assessing questionable forensic evidence. By the time of Howard's appeal in 1997, West had been the subject of several media exposés. He had resigned from 2 forensics organizations and been suspended from a 3rd. West's bite mark testimony was the only physical evidence linking Howard to the crime scene. The police found no blood, semen, hair, or any other biological evidence that could be traced back to him. There was some other evidence against him, but in the majority opinion, Chief Justice Dan Lee acknowledged that the state's case was largely reliant on West. He also noted that numerous scholarly authorities had called bite mark evidence into question, one of the first court opinions to do so. That welcome bit of skepticism in a majority opinion suggested that, at least one time, the Mississippi High Court had come tantalizingly close to declaring that bite mark analysis wasn't scientifically reliable enough to be used in criminal trials. But not close enough. Instead, Lee argued that the bite mark evidence in Howard's case was fine because Howard had been given the opportunity to challenge West in court. This is precisely the sort of scenario that the Supreme Court's Daubert decisions were supposed to preclude. Leaving the interpretation of bite mark evidence to the jury relegated the most critical question, is this legitimate science, to the adversarial nature of a criminal trial, in which a jury's decision could be influenced by a wide range of factors not at all related to science. The most relevant such factor was usually the respective charisma and persuasiveness of the opposing experts. To Mississippi juries, West was a hometown hero who gave lectures in China and to the FBI, yet still chose to continue practicing dentistry in Hattiesburg and help put bad guys away in Mississippi. Prosecutors, with West's help, often portrayed defense witnesses and West's critics as hired guns motivated by professional jealousy to tear West down. In his opinion in Eddie Lee Howard versus State of Mississippi, Justice Smith made the arguments that he'd resurrect in the bologna sandwich case a few months later. He pointed out that West had already testified 40 times in 6 states, and that bite mark evidence had been accepted in every court in which it had been submitted. He scolded his colleagues for expressing any skepticism about bite mark evidence at all, writing that the majority had left an impression that this court does not favor allowing such evidence, and for suggesting that there is little consensus in the scientific community to support the claims of bite mark analysts. This is clearly the minority view nationwide, Smith wrote. He was right about the courts. They had bought into bite mark matching. He was wrong about actual scientists. Few had, if any. Had the court barred bite mark evidence and Michael West in 1997, it seems likely that it would have ended or at least curtailed his career. It probably also would have forced a re-examination of countless cases, including those of LaVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer. But it didn't happen. The Mississippi Supreme Court would revisit Michael West and bite mark matching several times in the years to come. The justices' line on the controversy would get increasingly strident, defensive, and protective of West and his discipline. More people would go to prison, and Kennedy Brewer would nearly be executed. In the fall of 1994, West made a move that would expand and solidify his position in Mississippi. He ran for coroner of Forest County. He won. West now held an official state position. For a man who collected titles and credentials, it was a smart move. Of course, West's ability to win an election made him no more credible or knowledgeable than before. But a good chunk of the public doesn't know the difference between a coroner and a medical examiner. They may assume that, simply by virtue of the office, coroners must know a lot about forensic pathology. An elected title also gave West power, authority, and bargaining power. It gave him more access to state officials, and likely made him more credible still in the eyes of police, prosecutors, judges, and juries. Most importantly, it gave him a platform. He'd use it to protect the status he and Hain had attained within the state's death investigation system. Meanwhile, it wasn't long before Emily Ward ran into problems. Soon after taking office, Ward began trying to standardize the way autopsies were done in Mississippi. When she noticed the way Hain was working, she tried to tell her superiors. She was told to shut up. It also didn't take long for the incumbent powers to take notice of Ward. Within just a few months of her appointment, and almost immediately after she tried to impose some oversight onto the autopsy system, Hain complained about Ward to DPS Commissioner Jim Ingram, alleging she had demonstrated professional incompetence. And even early on, Some of the state's coroners wanted nothing to do with Ward. In Coahoma County, for example, Coroner Charles Scott told his county board of supervisors that he'd keep using Hayne, despite warnings from Ward and his own police officials. The local paper reported that he described Hayne as just as qualified as Ward, if not more so, and told the supervisors, "When it comes to a difficult homicide, Hayne is going to be my man, whether she, Ward, likes it or not." West and Hayne would later sign a newspaper ad endorsing Scott in his bid for re-election. Frustrated, Ward contacted George McCormick, the medical examiner in North Louisiana, and Chris Sperry, the deputy chief medical examiner in Atlanta. He would later become the Georgia State medical examiner. The three of them began looking into Hayne's background. As it turns out, by the time Ward reached out to him, McCormick had already heard complaints about Hayne from other medical examiners in the region. Part of McCormick's motivation was undoubtedly personal. Hayne and West had begun expanding their autopsy empire into Louisiana, particularly into McCormick's part of the state. So he was losing business to them. Local officials said they switched to Hayne because McCormick was slow with his reports. But McCormick told the Associated Press it was because he sometimes disagrees with police over what led to a death. He added, "I'm not supposed to be a yes man for the police." Like Ward, McCormick was troubled by the number of autopsies he heard Hayne had been doing, and he worried about the stories he was hearing about the quality of Hayne's work. So he asked his lab director, Don Young, to begin compiling a file. Young first looked into some of the publications Hayne listed on his CV. Some didn't appear to exist. Many weren't from medical or forensic journals. One other article Hayne had listed as published was actually just a letter to the editor. Young also found several cases in which Hayne had failed to preserve tissue samples. In many cases, microscopic examination of tissue is a critical part of determining how an injury occurred. In her letters, Young recounted a correspondence with an attorney who wrote about an incident in May 1994 in which he had requested the preserved wet tissue from an autopsy Hayne had performed in a criminal case. In his reply, Hayne told the attorney that federal guidelines only recommend preserving wet tissue long enough to make a diagnosis. Since he had already made his diagnosis in the case, Hayne didn't retain the tissue. Hayne's explanation was wrong. There were no such federal guidelines. According to guidelines published by the College of American Pathologists, the certifying organization for pathology labs, wet tissue should be retained for 6 months, presumably to give opposing experts a chance to examine them, which is precisely what this attorney was trying to do. The decedent in that case had died 3 months earlier. Young found other cases in which Hayne also refused to produce wet tissue slides. In those cases, too, Hayne claimed he was merely following some federal law, regulation, or guideline. "He has been asked in the past to produce this rule," Young wrote, "but has failed to do so." In a letter to another attorney, Young wrote that Hayne's failure to produce slides was unheard of in the field of pathology. Other attorneys would complain about this in future cases. "Most autopsies produce 20 to 30 tissue samples," one Mississippi attorney who has faced Hayne in both civil and criminal cases said in a 2007 interview for Reason magazine. "I've never seen a tissue sample from a Stephen Hayne autopsy." In December 1993, Sperry wrote to both the American Board of Pathology and the American Academy of Forensic Sciences to request an ethics investigation into Hayne's qualifications. He argued that though Hayne was not board qualified in forensic pathology, as most forensic pathologists understood the term, he was deliberately confusing judges and juries by claiming certification from less credible groups with official-sounding names. He called Hayne a rather blatant fraud that is being perpetrated on the people of Mississippi, the forensic community, and the medico-legal system. Neither organization showed much interest. According to Sperry, no one seemed particularly interested in pursuing any matter that is not, quite frankly, a complete giveaway, and it appears that they will happily rationalize themselves out of any controversial situations, most probably to avoid any litigation that might arise from challenging any but the most obvious trespasses. This is yet another theme that would resonate throughout Haynes' career. Despite being made aware of his transgression,